My name is Jody Kretzmann, and what I want to do this evening is to just lead us into some discussion about the way in which our lives are shaped. I think without much fear of contradiction, that most of us, increasingly, every day, unless we've made some conscious decisions to do otherwise, find ourselves plugged in to a kind of electronic set of definitions of reality that increasingly determine how it is we think about the world and what it is we do in the world. And this seems to me an important enough and constantly changing enough dimension in our lives to spend some time thinking about it together. So that's what this is about tonight. I bring with me tonight a sort of lifelong, and I certainly don't want to brag about it, a lifelong addiction to news. I am a news junkie. My first work out of college and university, where I was the editor of my daily newspaper, was in journalism. I was a reporter at Time Magazine for a while, and though I didn't stay at that job very long, I have dabbled in and out of journalism in the years since then. Continue to do a lot of freelance work, and for the past probably 15 years have been more involved on the other side of journalism, that is the increasingly important side made up of those people who try to manipulate the newspapers, manipulate the reporters and the news people, mostly involved in politics and government. So I've been on at least at various points in my life both ends of the journalism game, the dance that goes on between media manipulators and the media producers. So I want to talk about that a little bit, but the first thing I want to do is to invite your participation here at the beginning in a collection of some stories. Let me tell you briefly the framework that I'd like the stories to fit, and I hope we've got some folks here who have some stories who fit this framework. It seems to me that the way to a way into thinking about media, which in fact are new, which is, I mean, we're dealing with something here that really is not much more than 40 or 50 years old, certainly in the way that it's affecting our social and public life. But one way to think about media is a really simple kind of scheme like this. That is, that you've got a real world, you've got media, and then you've got all of us as consumers. Now, we have two identities, don't we? We all live in some dimension of a real world, a world where events are infinite, where relationships are multi-layered and complicated, where things happen to us all the time, where we are involved in a variety of projects and dimensions of our lives in various ways, real life goes on here at Holden or any place else. How is it then that this process, this mediating process, this in-the-middle process, right, takes a look at all of this complex stuff going on in the real world and decides what it is that it does to produce for us, the consumers, us this time, not as participants necessarily in the real world, but as a public, as consumers of an interpretation of events? How is it that these mediating events, these mediating glasses get put on to people so that something comes out for us as consumers of something called news, which then interprets this mess? This is messy stuff over here in the real world. This is real messy stuff. How do the categories get put on so that we then can have a language, right, and a shared set of perceptions to talk about what's going on in the world? That's what media are about. They mediate between this messy reality and a set of categories which we as consumers then can talk about. All right, is that sort of what? Now here's some stories that I want you to help me collect. I think I would be surprised if we don't have a whole lot of these in the room. I want you to think about times in your life where you are participating in real world events as a real world person, and the event for some reason or other catches the eye of the media. It's reported. Somehow it gets defined as news. And then, the next morning, or that evening as you watch the news, you see it as a consumer of the news. That is, you have participated in an event, the media have also interacted with that event, interpreted them themselves, and you've seen what they have done to the event that you were a part of. You understand the kind of story I'm talking about here? I think a lot of us have those kinds of stories. My own view is that those stories are so interesting to me that I'm thinking about collecting a whole bunch of them, because it seems to me that I'm interested in places where there's a contradiction, where what it is you see on the evening news about an event that you know perfectly well because you participated in it bears little or no relationship to the actual event, right? And I want to think about what has happened to mediate that event, right? And what sense it makes for the media to have done what it did to that event so that it's almost unrecognizable to the participants, all right? Let me start off with a couple of my own and then invite you to join. My brother Mark reminded me of this the other day because we were last month, he and I were watching the CBS Evening News, and Dan Rather intoned in his most intoning voice that CBS would now be updating us on the 10-year anniversary of the Nicaraguan Revolution, right? And that we would now switch to Nicaragua for a report on the 10th year anniversary of the Sandinista Revolution. And what followed then was about an 8-minute segment, very, you know, a lot of valuable time on a 22-minute news segment for CBS National News on the 10th year anniversary of the Sandinista Revolution, which I learned later had drawn hundreds of thousands of people to Managua, had a number of fascinating decisions made about the future of the economy. Ortega announced a number of new moves that had to do with the economy, a number of new foreign relations moves, a number of interesting moves about releasing more Contras out of the jails and so forth. There was a lot of news, in other words, at this event. Was any of that news what was reported on Dan Rather that night? No. No, what Dan Rather did was turn it over to his correspondent in Nicaragua, and we got an 8-minute sort of quick biography of a fellow named Nicolas Bolaños. Nicolas Bolaños, according to CBS News, was the sort of apotheosis of the failure of the Sandinista Revolution. He was a landowner who had been an important part of the sort of respectable criticism of the Nicaraguan regime under Somoza, right? Who had attempted, according to CBS, to cooperate with the Sandinista Revolution, and for his pain at trying to cooperate with the Sandinista Revolution, so the CBS version ran, he was persecuted. His land was taken from him. They stole the land from Nicolas Bolaños and ran a bunch of his family out of the country, and were continuing, in fact, to persecute Nicolas Bolaños, who in the meantime was valiantly trying to reorganize an opposition party to the Sandinista Revolution. Well, this on the 10th anniversary of the Sandinista Revolution was the summary of those 10 years that we got in CBS News. Now, the reason it fits into these categories is that in April I was in Nicaragua with a group that was looking at a variety of urban issues in Managua. And we decided we had to, as if we had only a week in Managua, we had to at some point talk with somebody who would, we talked to actually a number of people, but one leadership person who would articulate for us the sort of standard anti-Sandinista line as it gets explained now in Nicaragua these days. And we got the head of the largest opposition party to talk to our group one day. And he was a fairly articulate guy, had a lot of critiques of the Sandinista Revolution, and you know, some of them were well taken, others of them, I thought anyway, were probably not well taken. But next to him, as we met around a boardroom table, was a guy with white, wavy black, white hair and dark sunglasses. And this guy would interrupt the party head about every 30 seconds or so. Not publicly, but he would sort of lean over and the conversation would stop and this guy would say a couple of words to the party head, clearly prompting the party head as to what the party head should be telling us about what the question under discussion was. And this went on for a long time, and we finally, somebody finally got around to say, well, would you mind introducing your colleague who's, who's next to you here telling you all these things? And so we were introduced to Nicholas Bolaños. Now, then for the next week, this was our first, really our first day in Managua. For the next week, in virtually every meeting we went to, people would refer to Nicholas Bolaños, people in Managua, in Nicaragua. Nicholas Bolaños is on the payroll of the CIA, right? He has been adopted by the American Embassy as the primary spokesperson for the landowning class in Nicaragua, right? The story of his interaction with the Sandinistas is that he was in fact pro-Somoza to the last moment. He resisted the Sandinista takeover, and he owns thousands and thousands of hectares of land, and he has refused ever to put that land into production. In other words, his way of sabotaging the Nicaraguan economy is to refuse to grow anything, either for export or locally. The Sandinistas, for 8 years, have been trying to persuade him to say, look, we're not going to take your land. Just grow something on it. Just use it. We're a poor country. We need the food. Just grow something on it, and we'll leave you alone. He refuses to do it. So finally, the Sandinistas took part of the land, not for themselves, but redistributed it to peasants on the condition that the peasants would actually farm it and produce something, right? In the meantime, Bolaños had pretty much liquidated as much as he could of his property in the city, and his family had emigrated to Miami with millions of dollars, right? Took millions of dollars with them to Miami, to the immigrant community there. And Bolaños had continued, therefore, to stay in Managua, was making a handsome living on the payroll of the CIA and at sort of at the behest of the American Embassy. So there I am last month sitting in my living room in Chicago, and Rather tells me that we're going to hear about the 10th anniversary of the Sandinista Revolution. I said, great, you know, we don't get very much news from down there. This will be real interesting. But here comes Nicholas Bolaños as the 10th anniversary story about the Nicaraguan Revolution. And I was absolutely astounded. Now, it raises for me questions about what it is that's going on in the news gathering operation there in Managua and the interpretation of events in New York City at CBS headquarters that allowed such a blatant, it seemed to me, a travesty of what was actually a news story, a terrific news story, to go on to national news. We can talk about what might have happened that made that possible. I want to do one other thing about that. We had a few beers one night in the International Hotel there, in the Intercontinental in Managua, yeah, where all the news people from Western Europe and the United States hang out, and they very seldom leave that hotel, as far as we could tell. So I have a sense of what the mindset is of the news people who would think that the way to cover the 10th anniversary was to interview Nicholas Bolaños. One other second story, and then I want to get a couple from you. A lot of these stories where one participates as an actor in the real world and then is astounded at what the media have done to that, right? Actor or observer, right? A lot of those stories, it seems to me, happen to people who are in politics or government. If you've ever tried to organize in government or political campaigns, organize something to happen, you know that one of the major considerations in organizing something is to think through very carefully how the media will interpret what it is you're doing, right? And there really is this sort of dance constantly between political organizers and the media that goes on. And we in Chicago in the last 6 years have not been real successful at interpreting what we think would be a fair or at least reality-based interpretation of the first black mayor, Harold Washington, and his successors, at least in the campaigns. One quickie about that, I could go on forever on the Washington stuff, because I worked with these questions with his administration quite closely for his administrations. I was involved on the policy end, developing particularly the housing and economic development policy questions for the most recent mayoral candidate, Tim Evans, in Chicago, the most recent black political candidate, kind of a an inheritor to some degree of the Washington platform, And we have been having a lot of trouble with the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago Sun-Times, which are the two major white-owned newspapers in downtown Chicago. And let me just give you one quick illustration of how impossible it is sometimes to recognize what it is one has done in the media reporting of it. Even when you've scripted it for, you know, you've given them a script, they can easily alter it. We put together a housing platform that we thought was a compilation of the most innovative and best ideas we could find across the country for low-income housing. And how, you know, Chicago, like every other major city, has a huge gap between people who need housing and the amount of available low-income housing. We had all kind of wonderful schemes for getting low-income people themselves to build their housing, and a variety of interesting schemes for where the financing was going to come from and so forth. And it was, some other experts looked at it and said, wow, that's really interesting. You put together some stuff that nobody's ever put together there. Well, we also put together, I think, a well-scripted, very slick, photogenic set of opportunities for Tim as the candidate to announce this stuff. And so there he was in a very, in a housing project which had both all of the sort of dumpiness of the worst of housing projects, but also some of the promise of what can happen when folks take charge of their own economies and begin to do something. So we had both things there, people ready to interview and so forth. A lot of good stuff. You could have written a really good story about that. Let me tell you the two headlines the next morning. Here's the Tribune. The Tribune says, Tribune's headline was, Daley backs more low-income housing. Now, what they had done was they had covered Tim Evans' press conference, and then they had called his opposition, Richard Daley, and asked Daley's response to Evans's proposals. And Daley had said that he backed them, or at least that he thought that there ought to be more low-income housing, too, in Chicago, and he thought there ought to be fewer homeless. And the Tribune, which was fairly blatant about their sides in this political campaign, headlined Daley's position on that. Courageous move by our now mayor. The Sun-Times headline, in some ways, was even funnier. The Sun-Times headline read, "Realtors rip Evans proposals." All right. So they, too, had gone to the press conference, gone through all the materials, and called the leading real estate agents in town. So, what do you think about this? And the real estate agents, not surprisingly, had said, oh, this is terrible, let's let the market do it. You know, there's no reason for government to intervene in low-income housing. I think both of those headlines are stories. I think Daley's position on low-income housing is a story, and I think what the realtors think about the housing question is a story. Unfortunately, from our point of view, none of them was the story that we were involved in trying to create, you know, or highlight out of the real world. And that's the kind of thing that happens to people in politics all the time. I'm sure many of you have experienced that kind of thing yourself. Well, I'd like to stop for a minute and collect a few from you, and then reflect on what we're hearing a little bit further. People have experiences about doing something in the real world? Yeah.
Well, this is kind of alongside of some of the management of news, which I'm becoming more and more convinced happens, like you say. But even if there's not that happening, living in a small city, I have an agency and we'll have educational events or we'll have things going on. And one of the things that happens, just as a part of the time squeeze and the all that's going on, is you start seeing what happens about what's covered, because media comes in for 2 minutes during an event. And what's on for those 2 minutes, if it's newsworthy, it gets covered. If that's like a sub-point 5 under a main point, that's what gets covered. So even if there isn't, just the pure way things are covered is running from one end of town to another, and very little background work, and is that there'll be, you know, something very meaningless covered. And so even if, you know, that's another whole part
Sure, especially for TV and radio. Not, I think what you're talking about doesn't happen that much with print reporters.
Yeah, that is not.
But we really had to work with Harold Washington a lot because he insisted on speaking in complete sentences. And if that's, which is just death if you want media coverage, right? The last thing you want to do is speak in complete and grammatical and literate ways. With a complete thought, right? And, you want sound bites. You want 6, 8, 10, 15 second sound bites if you want coverage. One of the real advantages of our current mayor, Richie Daley the second, is that he has never spoken a complete sentence in his life. So he is an ideal candidate for TV coverage. Mike Royko, our columnist in Chicago, once wrote about Richie Daley that he never exited the same sentence that he entered. And that it does help him, at least with TV and radio, they're able to follow.
Love that, Mike Royko.
Other stories about things that you've been involved in, Jeannie?
Paul and I, my husband and I, were in Israel in 1974, and we had the opportunity to visit the West Bank, and we were taken out there by someone from the Lutheran World Federation, so somebody who was probably pretty neutral in the situation, and we're shown some of the Arabs and the way they were treated and why their homes were bombed and so on. And one of the Arabs said to us, he said, you know, we call ourselves resistors. We just want to live in our homes and not be removed. And we've been here for hundreds of years. And we just want to live in peace with the Jewish people who have moved in. He said, and yet your newspapers take and call us terrorists and only give you a portion and a side of that story. So when we went back to the Quad Cities, one church asked us to come and show our slides about Israel. And we happened to mention this, how as Americans we were only getting one side of the story, and that the Christian Arabs, and we emphasized Christian Arabs, whose homes were being bombed, just wanted us to know the other side of the story. And I think Paul and I are fairly diplomatic type people, and we weren't trying to show one side stronger than the other, because we both believed that the Jewish people needed a homeland and need a homeland, so we're very much pro-Jewish also. We're just trying to show two sides of the story, and the church that we shared our slides and stories with became extremely angry and belligerent at us for even suggesting that there was another side to the story, because they had only heard the one side from the media. It was frightening, it was scary, it was sad, it was frustrating.
So there's certain sort of preset categories in some cases that you just can't escape from, seemingly anyway, in the media. Yeah, Bob.
I had a chance in March of 88 to be in Nicaragua at the time that the Marines were flown down to the southern border of Honduras, the 4,500 Marines, and it was interesting and a little frightening to me to realize that back home there were demonstrations against the event, because people were afraid that American blood was going to be spilled if we invaded Nicaragua or whatever. The people in Nicaragua knew full well that what had happened there was that our administration had sent 4,500 Marines down there, left the supplies with the Contras and flown home again after Congress had turned down, you know, aid to the Congress, humanitarian aid to the Contras. It was frightening to me to see that our media didn't even pick up on that. Mm-hmm. And that's really what happened. Mm-hmm. And everybody in Nicaragua knew it. Mm-hmm. And our public was blacked out. Mm-hmm.
So there really was a story there that just didn't get picked up and covered.
In the early 70s, the peace movement mounted, I think, the largest demonstration of any kind for any cause whatever. In Washington, D.C., there was, a million people. I mean, it was huge. And the media never touched it. They completely ignored it.
Yeah, I think lots of people who have taken part in demonstrations will feel that the coverage, whatever happens the next day, certainly doesn't capture some of what was going on in the demonstration. Yeah.
I think it was interesting, you're late into to say what the media has done to your story, and I think this that facts and news are sort of an oxymoron in many respects. I've been interviewed a number of times because of entrepreneurial kinds of things, and at one point we were doing a major development, real estate development, that was picked up by NBC because it was at a time when housing in the Bay Area, in San Francisco, Oakland, Bay Area, had reached about 187,000 as a mean, which was quite some time ago because it's about 260-some thousand right now. But at that point, we were building entry-level homes, 6,000 square feet, lots for about 70,000, about 60 minutes away, 60 miles away, basically, from San Francisco. And the media picked it up, came out with television, wanted to get the whole story of exactly what was happening. They heard that people were driving a long way for housing, and that this was something they wanted to promote. The story that came out of that was was a good enough story in itself, but the facts didn't seem to fit. When the story came out, instead of $70,000 homes, there were $50,000 homes. There were thousands of people standing in line for housing, which was not the case. We were getting a significant number of people coming up from the Bay Area to purchase and driving back to work. But the embellishment of the facts themselves, and when the story came out, really had nothing much to do with the real facts in the case.
Good. Okay.
Yeah. A year ago, I was involved in organizing a visit by Archbishop Desmond Tutu to Madison, Wisconsin. And in preparation for this, we organized a large committee, of which was a publicity committee. And we brought in the vice president of one of the clinics, vice president for broadcasting or public relations in the clinic, to help us with the news coverage and directing the news the way we wanted it to go. And it was interesting to go through the process, how they sat us down and said, you know, we had to get our cover stories and get all our so-called spin-off stories set up for the media. They described the media as relatively lazy. Mm-hmm. If you place a story in their lap, they won't research it to, you know, get the story. They'll just take and run to their typewriter. But even in doing that, sort of two examples. The first was, you know, this was an event sponsored by two churches in Madison, and it was in celebration of the merger of the two churches. And so we wanted to really, you know, make sure everyone knew that. And so that's what we wanted to be the news, you know, Tutu is coming in celebration of this. And I was kind of excited and nervous at the same time, because one reporter called me up and said, "Can I come do a story about this?" And I said, "Oh, sure, it sounds fun." So we did it, and it came out in the, well, I think it was actually in the newspaper this time, but it came out that the churches, it said it was sponsored by local churches in the very last paragraph. And we emphasized about three or four times during the interview, you know, to make sure they understood where sponsorship was coming from. It hardly even entered the article, and it was, you know, what they thought news was different than what we were trying to present our facts.
Sure.
And also, when Desmond Tutu did come and give the speech or the lecture or address, I don't say this to demean Native Americans, but there was one sentence in there he mentioned sort of empathy with Native Americans out of his hour of speech about South Africa. And the major newspaper in Madison had huge headlines sort of to the fact that Tutu is concerned about Native Americans, which is good. But they ignored all the rest of the whole speech, which talked about South Africa and the plight of, you know, Democrat or Republican, we shouldn't support, and that type of struggle.
Interesting. So what they did was they fit it into an already existing story, since Wisconsin at that point was really wrapped up in Native American issues.
Yeah, fishing rights are still, to this day.
Yeah, that's interesting. That happens, I think, so. Yeah.
An example of fitting it into a story. I'm a member of the city council in the city where I live, and we just, 3 weeks ago, adopted a change in our general plan having to do with agricultural preservation. And we were very sensitive to, we were anticipating news coverage. And so we had a carefully mapped out plan to give advance information to the news media. We had two or three different nights of public hearings before our planning commission. We had a very concise summary done of the staff report about the whole issue. When the media first picked it up, they of course wanted to talk about it in terms of no growth. That was the buzzword that they had chosen. And so because of that, we mapped out this campaign so that we wouldn't fit what they wanted us to fit, mm-hmm. as being a no-growth policy. Because what we were talking about was, what do we do in 15 years when the property that's presently zoned for residential use is no longer available?
Yeah.
So that we weren't dealing with an immediate problem. We were talking about a future problem very clearly. We had two nights of public hearings before the city council. I went out of my way to make statements addressed to the press that we're not talking about a no-growth policy. We're just talking about where are we going to put, and we have other places to put things besides the agricultural, and the issue was agricultural preservation. So we ended up adopting a strong agricultural preservation and right to farm legislation. And it was very innovative what we've adopted for the right to farm ordinance that we're going to be working on. And that's what we thought should get attention. And sure enough, as soon as we got through with the whole program, we heard in the media that the city was the first city in the community to adopt a no-growth policy. And they said that many developers have said that this signals the first adoption of a no-growth policy. And in fact, no developer testified at any of the hearings or sent written testimony to the city council contending that they were concerned we were adopting a no-growth policy. There was one developer that's a hospital that wants to expand into agricultural land that's adjacent to them, and that was it. And I got called over to a press conference to a live, it was part of the 6 o'clock news. So I was invited to come over to be interviewed on the air. And you go in before you're interviewed and you have a pre-interview briefing where they tell you what they're going to ask you. And they read to me their lead that they already prepared for the story before they interviewed anybody. And the lead was totally wrong. I argued with them about their lead. They refused to change their lead and went forward with the whole thing anyway. And the headline that came out was that the city had adopted a no-growth policy. So they ended up saying at the end exactly what they were looking for at the beginning.
Again.
Despite the fact that what happened in between didn't fit.
Impossible to break out of the pre-existing formula.
Yeah.
Well, could you have thrown them a curve by...
I did one thing, that was that I was so angry at them that I answered the questions differently on the air than I had in the briefing. And I caused the reporter to make a significant pause in her, so she was taken aback. And the other thing that happened was this reporter that was doing the story had not been in town. In fact, she was out of town doing something else and had just arrived 15 minutes before the news program.
Yeah.
And she was shoved a script that somebody else had prepared, and the public viewing the 6 o'clock news had the impression that this reporter had covered this story, had
totally
done
on
some
top,
research, right? Was on top of the whole thing, and was giving us, you know, the news.
Yeah.
And in fact, she wasn't even anywhere around.
Yeah.
Had no idea what was going on.
Yeah. That's fun. Yeah. Let me back off for just a minute the specific stories, which are really wonderful. Sounds like we could go on for a while here, and suggest a few things that might be going on, and sort of if we stepped away from the specifics for just a second, if I might. That it seems to me, you know, if you follow this very simplistic sort of schema here that we've been talking about, that you can ask two kinds of, let me be real simple-minded here, you can ask two kinds of questions about this schema. You can ask questions about what's going on in the relationship between media people and the real world. That is, what is this? What's this arrow here about? How do media people interact with real world reality to come up with their own sets of categories and priorities, right? This, in other words, one set of questions is right in here in this intersection. Another set of questions has to do with this intersection over here. That is, how are all of us, as the public, as consumers, affected by what happens with the media, as recipients and so forth, right? What I'd like to do for just a minute is suggest a little bit about this set of questions, and then maybe ask you to help me think a little bit about this, because people are just beginning now, I think, in the United States and other advanced industrial countries to think more about this second set of questions. Yeah, Paul?
I'm not sure whether this is the place for it. I mean, you can put it off if you want to, but I heard a broadcaster who was also a Christian maintaining that the commercial interests make a big difference in the whole equation.
Yeah.
And that the bottom line, as far as the broadcaster on a commercial network is concerned, is not the programs, not even the news program, but the commercial, which is presumably getting new customers or new consumers for the product that's being advertised.
Yeah, certainly from the business end, that's true.
So the bad news is the program, including the news, and the good news, as far as the broadcaster is concerned, is the commercial. Now, does that suggest, is it being too cynical, for instance, to think that maybe Dan Rather knows where his bread is buttered, and when he put that clip on of 8 minutes telling about the 10th anniversary of the of the Nicaraguan Revolution, that he knows that his commercial sponsors are not going to sit still for the kind of story that you expected him to tell?
I think in the larger sense, there's a lot to be said about that. That's a good question, Paul. I think in the larger sense, that's right. But you will never find a good reporter who will tell you
that
any commercial interest or advertising interest, whether in print or in electronic media, have anything to do with their choices. I would argue that one should take that statement by reporters seriously and begin to think about some of the ways in which this gets distorted, the real world, in terms, at least first, of how reporters operate and how they interact with the real world. In the larger sense, though, you're right. It is all business. Right?
And is it any better with McNeil and Lehrer, for instance? They're public television.
Slightly different, I think.
They don't
have yeah, slightly different. They've got a different public to answer to, don't they? Okay. Yeah. Let me just say a couple things, if I might, about this one, though, just to see if it triggers any further stuff, because this is where any reporter operates in this realm. Let me say a couple of things about how the news gets defined. Simple things. How the news gets gathered, and finally how it gets reported. Okay? This is from the point of view of people who are gathering and reporting, defining gathering and reporting the news. First,
are you talking about the print and electronic?
Print and electronic. I think what I'll say, some of the categories fits one more than the other. But generally, how does a reporter think? Because that defines what goes on here. And will, I think, speak to some of the examples we've got. Some simple things, if you think about them, I think they really affect what we see. What's news? How does news get defined? Well, one thing news is it's new. Right? If you think about all the important things in the world that are not new, right, but that are still important, 99% of the world is immediately locked out of being defined as news. Right? Just think about what the category of news is, and how much of the world and how much of understanding the world is locked out just by that. You have to cut it as a new thing, or it won't fly.
Does it have to be tragic?
Not necessarily.
Isn't
we
that
can talk
what
about
most news is though?
Yeah, there are categories of news. Let me maybe skip to that. There, yeah, you know, people have one whole category. It seems to me is that news has to fit some pre-existing formulas. Now, sometimes those formulas are interpretive. That is, this is a no-growth story, no matter what you say it is, right? Because that's a pre-existing formula, and we understand these issues in that category. Other formulas, though, are like that. A human heroism, you know, individual heroism stories have a pattern to them. I mean, you could, if you've written one, you could write 500. You know exactly how to write a fireman rescues a baby story, right?
And you know exactly that that's a story that's going to be on the front page. It's part of a formula that will immediately be grabbed and will assume a kind of mythic importance, at least in the eyes of a news editor. Other kinds of interpretive formulas, it seems to me, that can explain things. Lots of the world has been explained for the last 40 years in terms of East and West, that is Moscow and Washington, right? If you watch the news media these days, one of the major problems they're having, the national news media, is in trying to figure out how to report global news without using that formula, with all of the stuff that Gorbachev has done and all of the ways in which that relationship, Moscow and Washington, is shifting. Means they might have to take North and South relationships seriously and actually report on what's going on in Latin America or Africa or Asia, rather than report what Moscow and Washington think is going on in Nicaragua. Right? So that has been a formula, a kind of set of glasses through which news professionals have seen the world. Right? And if you can't report it through those glasses, it's not news. Other kinds of form. There's a way to report crime, which is a sort of formulaic way to report crime. And often that formula gets formed by the institution that has the most most to do with defining what that event is. So in this case, crime comes to us in formulas which make sense to police. Right? Crime does not come to us in categories which make sense to people who do, quote, crimes, right? It could, I mean, that's part of the real world, isn't it? Right? It could come to us in terms of the framework that victims use, right? It doesn't. It comes to us in categories that the police use in our at-home world, right? So the formulas get formed sometimes by the most powerful institutions that have to do with the events. Events. I just used the word events. Another way of thinking about what's news, how news gets defined, is often it's events. Think about everything in life that is not sort of an event. I mean, I suppose you could say that everything is an event in some way or other. But I'm thinking about trends. I'm thinking about relationships. I'm thinking about longer-term questions that are in front of. For instance, poverty is not a story, but a riot in a poor community is. Right? If there's an event to hang a story on it, then it becomes definable as news. It is not news that there are more and more homeless every day, right? If something happens to a homeless person, if a couple, you know, die in unusual circumstances or something, that can be an event which focuses then on a larger set of questions. So there's a sort of event-centeredness about it.
So the sensationalism of that particular category is what you're saying.
I think so. What do we mean by sensationalism? I think we mean it's an event, right? That it often fits a kind of heroic formula, right? That we can that we know and we're familiar with and so forth, and that it communicates to us at some sort of deep level, deeper really than the event itself in lots of ways. Another dimension of this, it seems to me news most often, at least in the American press, and I don't think the European press even is as guilty as we are of this, but news in the United States often has to be personalizable. That is, you have to be able, if you want to cover a trend, if you want to cover Black America, you better have a Jesse Jackson. And the news is about Jesse, right? If you want to cover the women's movement, you better have a Gloria Steinem, right? There needs to be often for the news, for reporters, a way to hang larger trends on personalities, on people who become larger than life symbols of larger trends in the society. A very kind of individualistic way of going at stuff. You don't find that too much at least quite as much, I think, in press outside the United States.
We contribute to that in political campaigns by trying to create events.
Well, that's right. And it's a sort of chicken and egg question here. Right. It's a chicken and egg question, knowing that the media thrive on the politics of personality. We create a politics of personality for it to thrive on, right? And it sort of feeds itself in an endless cycle, which doesn't, I think, make any of us wiser. One other way it seems to me that news gets defined is, and we've alluded to this already, news gets defined as whatever the most powerful set of actors that interact with that particular news event say it is. Police define crime. right? Government in Washington basically defines the framework through which one defines whatever news is in countries where the government in Washington has anything to do, right? Powerful institutions can define the news. I have a lot more to say about that. Let me just quickly say a word or two about gathering the news and reporting the news. You all know that most news gets gathered via a beat system, right? If you're working on a newspaper in some electronic media, most often you've got a set of institutions to cover. You're on a beat. You're on the police beat, or you're on the court beat, or you're on the politics beat, or you're on City Hall, or you're on fashion, or whatever, right? Let me just say a couple things about the beat system and how it frames what we read as critical consumers. This is what this is all about. It's trying to make us a little bit more critical consumers here. Not bashing the media, but trying to understand how it works so we know what we read when we read it, right? It seems to me the beat system has the advantage, partly, of avoiding what you ran into with that reporter. That is, if you're on a beat, there's a chance that you might actually, as a reporter, know something about what it is you're covering. The chance. It's not foolproof, but there's certainly a better chance that you might know something. And you're less likely, if you're on a beat, if I'm covering the police in Chicago every day, I'm less likely to miss a big story. You know, it's less likely if I'm with the Tribune, it's less likely that sometimes it's going to beat me at a big police story. If you think about a couple of the disadvantages, it seems to me that one thing you see every day with the press who are on a beat is that, and think about it, you wouldn't do anything differently yourselves. If you're a reporter, the last thing in the world you can afford to do is to offend your major sources, right? If you're a police reporter, if I'm a police reporter for the Tribune, my livelihood depends on my good relationships with everybody in that district station up from sergeant on. I mean, if I say something lousy about the cops in the streets in tomorrow morning's Tribune, what do you think my reception is going to be when I get down to the station tomorrow afternoon?
You won't get another story.
You bet. How willing are they going to be? All the stuff is going to go to the Sun-Times. None of it's going to come to the Tribune. I'm going to be iced out. That's part of what happened, I think, in the Nicaragua story that I shared earlier. I think that at certain times, if I'm a reporter for the New York Times in Nicaragua, my major source of news is the U.S. Embassy. I might wish it to be differently. I might wish to be able to sort of cover the complexities of that society and to listen carefully to what the government of Nicaragua is telling me, and at least to weigh that somewhere. But I know that my major contact and my major source of news and the stuff I absolutely have to have if I ever want to make page one of the New York Times, right, and the reporters are always vying for that kind of stuff, who's at the top of the hour, who's on page one, is the U.S. Embassy. And my relationship with the U.S. Embassy has to be a good one. You know, now, different reporters play with those kinds of relationships and are able to distance themselves more or less from their major institutional sort of sponsors and ties. But it's very difficult to do. It's very difficult to do. And it seems to me that that's... you know, the other thing that happens is if think about yourself again in this kind of position, if you cover a beat long enough and are close enough to the State Department or the Pentagon, say you're CBS person in the Pentagon, you begin to adopt the view of the world that that institution has, right? There's nothing insidious about this. You're not lying. The Pentagon has a view of the world. You're with these guys every day. You're down in the war room, right? They're playing their computer games. They see stuff in Moscow and Washington. They understand the world in a very sort of narrow and militarized way. But they are all you talk to. You know, you're not out with the peace demonstrators. You're certainly not in other parts of the world talking to other people with other viewpoints of the United States military. You are with the Pentagon, and you begin thinking that way. I think you see in the older reporters and the networks, people who have really adopted the point of view of the institutions that they've been covering for years. So that now, you know, you get cases where some of the older guys go over to be sort of public spokesmen for the State Department, for the Pentagon, and so forth. And it's not much different for them, right? They can say the same stuff speaking for the Pentagon as they said the night before reporting on the Pentagon. Well, beat system, advantages and disadvantages. Finally, just a word about how the news, we've talked about defining, gathering, just a word about reporting. In journalism school, although I didn't go to one, I knew about it when I was a journalist, and it still happens, I think, in a slightly different way these days. You're taught that there's a way to report. And the way to report is, anybody here know about the inverted pyramid, right? The triangle sort of on its head, right? Who, what, when, where, and how on the top. I mean, that's what you lead with, the facts, who, what, when, where, how. All interpretive material is secondary, is less important. What's important is the specific, concrete facts of the specific story, right? And you lead with that, and if there's time later on, you get to what it means, or how it ties to greater events, and so on. And that's the way reporters are taught to think. Now think about that just for a second in terms of, it's the only thing I'll say about this, in terms of its effect on the public and consumers. I mean, I want to ask questions like, are we becoming a society that's incapable of doing in-depth interpretation of events? That is, of making the threads, making the connections, which allow us to understand some kind of a flow of what's happening, right? Are we so segmented in the way reality comes to us, because of the way media do things, that we can't make those connections? And if it's impossible for us to make those connections and to interpret reality in that way, aren't we therefore at a huge disadvantage in terms of changing reality, in terms of being citizens? Don't we need, as citizens, as actors in a democracy, don't we need a set of interpretations, a set of understandings? Don't we need the opposite of what some individual non-connected facts might give us? Right? So I guess ultimately my concern about this whole business is that it comes out to us in ways that may be making it more and more difficult to sustain a democracy, and maybe making it more and more difficult for any of us to think about ourselves in our public dimension and to be effective actors. That's my worry about this stuff. And that, it seems to me, is a challenge for us. Figure out how to use what we get through the media, interpret it, make our own linkages, and allow what we get to inform the critical capacities of citizens rather than to cut them off. You know, let me stop and see if there's some comments.
Are there any of these?
Well, I agree with you completely. That's my concern, too. But I'm having trouble making the connection from this inverted pyramid that says who, what, when, where, and how, which, the way I look at it, I see the, I mean, using Victor's story as an example, they are making an interpretation that isn't based on the facts.
Yeah, that's one of the ways the formula works, right? The formula presents them with an easy way not to ask why, that would push them. I mean, it would be work. It would be hard work for the reporters covering your story, Victor, to figure out a way of explaining that didn't sound just like PR for you, right? I mean, they want some critical distance from who it is they're reporting on. They want some way and the easiest thing for them to do is not to deal with the why at all. You notice there is no why in that top of that pyramid. But when they do deal with the why, deal with it in received categories that are formulas, right? Which is what they did with your story.
Well, it seems to be more of it. It seems like in the electronic media, that more of the way that the news is reported is entertainment. That it has to be entertainment, and that seems to kind of restrict what is reported.
Oh, a lot. Yeah, I didn't talk at all about TV, but you know, anybody who's worked with TV, the first thing you get talked about it is good visuals. If you can't produce good visuals, you don't have a story. And you know, think about the amount of the world that cuts out.
Well, they just wanted me there in this story that I talked about, so that it was a lead story, so they wanted to have a picture of somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And they already had plugged in what they thought I was supposed to say.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just the lead story that they could play up to advertise when the news was going to come on at 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
Or for the later 11 o'clock.
Yeah.
So, So I think that the entertainment factor causes a lot to be left out in the electronic media. And what's frightening to me about that is that I think that the majority of our citizens get their news from the electronic media.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I was going to ask, how about these news magazines? Is that a slower pace so you can get a semblance of more in-depth reporting from those?
What do you think?
Like TV news magazines?
2020.
You're talking about TV, yeah, I was thinking 60 TV. Minutes in 2020 and so on. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one. It is an attempt by television news producers to address some of the real limitations of TV as a medium to do anything in depth at all. Right? At least you've got something like 12 minutes of airtime to do a story, which is a huge amount of time for people who work in television. I think there are still limitations in what they do, but probably at least they can get more of a story on. Yeah, Mike?
My reaction, and I've followed this, my concern is the same as yours, because I've witnessed it and I see it happening all the time, especially during political campaign years, where people are just not aware. A lot of people are not aware of what a teleprompter is. And they are convinced that because the reporter or the anchor person or the politician is looking directly at the camera and speaking, that it's all off the top of their head and they're really talking to you.
Right.
And a lot of people, my favorite example is during the 84 campaign, Ronald Reagan, who was a master of using the teleprompter, had a two-minute, one of his short little ad things that were done, and at one point during this thing, he pauses and looks away and then looks back to the camera, as if he's thinking about what he's going to say next, naturally, and anybody that really knows what's happening is knowing that he's looking at the camera and the words are slowly rolling across the camera and he's reading them.
And probably it says pause.
Right.
Right.
Right. Sincere. But it really bothers me because I see the drama that's produced by news stories. All news stories have a beginning, middle, and end in a dramatic structure.
That's right. That's right. Last comment.
Okay. You have worked for Time Magazine. Is it as good or as bad as any? Because I sort of read it and I believe it,
Which magazine?
Talk about Time.
Oh, Time.
And in one sentence, I think that if you want a fairly intelligent American establishment view of the world, that Time and Newsweek are two good places to go for. It's not a place to go for any insight into what any of the other 96%, 94% of the world's population thinks about anything. But if you want a fairly well done American establishment view of the world, go to Time and Newsweek, and they do it okay.
My husband gets the Observer from England, and it is quite often a different viewpoint on the same subject.
That's right. We could talk a lot about ways in which we can broaden our media consumer sort of intake to modify some of what we get. The bell has rung, and I guess that means we've got to go. Thank you.